In Tuesday's 2nd of November's election, Republicans served notice that the clock is ticking on Democrats' slim majorities in Congress. On Friday, 5th of November, 13 House Republicans delivered the decisive votes to rescue a key part of President Joe Biden's agenda, an agenda endangered by those in his own party. Ensued a bloodletting. Biden's $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill passed late on Friday night and is headed for his signature after months of intense wrangling over the details, particularly whether it will be tied to a larger spending plan that progressives insisted upon passing alongside it. But in the end, it wasn't really those progressives who provided the key votes, but rather the 13 Republicans. The final vote count was 228 to 206, meaning if no Republicans had voted for the bill, it wouldn't have passed. And some Republicans are predictably furious, with undersold questions about House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy's future leadership of the party potentially in the offing. I can't believe Republicans just gave the Democrats their socialism bill, Representative Matt Gaetz, a Republican from Florida, tweeted. That 13 House Republicans provided the votes needed to pass this is absurd, Representative Chip Roy, a Republican from Texas, tweeted. Others threatened before the vote to target or launch primaries against the defectors in their midst. Vote for this infrastructure bill and I will primary the hell out of you, Representative Madison Cawthorn, a Republican from North Carolina, said shortly before the vote. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, in her typically understated fashion, warned last week that any Republicans who voted for the bill would be a traitor to our party, a traitor to their voters, and a traitor to our donors. After the vote, she accused the 13 Republicans of having voted to pass Joe Biden's communist takeover of America, and tweeted the phone numbers of their congressional officers. That would see such rhetoric from this particular, more extreme wing of the Republican Party isn't all that surprising, nor is it terribly surprising that at least some Republicans would vote for the bill. When it passed in the Senate, 19 Republicans voted for it, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky. Many saw it as an olive branch amid a Democratic push to eliminate the filibuster in the Senate, an obstruction tactic that doesn't apply in the House of Representatives. Last Friday's GOP defections were even more significant than during the last Trump impeachment, when 10 Republicans voted to impeach the former president, a historically high number. And the fact that on Friday, 5th of November, they provided the votes necessary for passage makes this even more fraught. They were also more significant than many, including Kevin McCarthy, suggested they might be. While McCarthy previously kept his powder dry on whipping against the bill, he ultimately pushed for his members to vote against it. As recently as last week, Kevin McCarthy said, "I don't expect few, if any, to vote for it, if it comes to the floor today." In another interview, he was asked about the infrastructure bill and said, "It will fail." Circumstances change, but the defections from Kevin McCarthy's party line were significant for the modern era. They also notably included Representative Nicole Malliotakis, a Republican from New York, who had been made part of the team led by Minority Whip Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana, just earlier this year, the same whipping operation that failed on Friday. Nicole Malliotakis comes from a region which stood to benefit more than others from the bill, and accounted for many of the GOP yes votes. 6 of the 13 defectors came from New York and New Jersey. But that one in particular has to sting. We knew at least a few Republicans would vote yes, and others were seemingly freed up to vote for the bill once it was headed for passage. but 10 Republicans voted for the bill rather quickly, and the eventual total number of defections gave the bill more than just a veneer of bipartisanship, especially when combined with a Senate vote. The National Review summed it up accordingly: disgraceful House Republicans rescue Joe Biden's failing agenda. 13 Republicans swooped in to rescue Nancy Pelosi, provide Joe Biden with the biggest victory of his presidency, and put the rest of his reckless agenda on a glide path to passage in the House. This is a substantively bad decision that is political malpractice. It represents a betrayal. Politically, it's unclear what Republicans are thinking. President Biden entered this week reeling from a devastating rebuke of his presidency by voters in areas of the country thought to be reliably Democratic. He headed into the 2022 election year a wounded animal, and Republicans stood to make major gains. Now they tossed him a life raft and allowed him to put bipartisan gloss on his radical agenda. Every Republican who voted for this monstrosity, who is not already retiring, should be primaried and defeated by candidates who will actually resist the left-wing agenda. Those who are retiring should be shamed for the rest of their lives. It also is not too soon to be asking whether Representative Kevin McCarthy should be ousted from leadership for his inability to keep his caucus together on such a crucial vote. And that last one is a key point here. The bill included lots of popular projects, and in another era, probably wouldn't have gotten significantly more GOP votes. But we live in this era in which delivering a political win for the other side, however popular the bill and however much your constituents might want it, is seen as apostasy. The demand in the GOP for such devotion to the party line and its election prospects is even greater than on the other side. Republicans are still likely to win the House in 2022 midterm elections, despite the doom and gloom on the GOP side, and even as it's likely the bill's passage will help Democrats electorally. That puts Kevin McCarthy in line to be House Speaker. But we've written before about the undersold potential debate over whether he would even be elevated to a post he's already failed to grab hold of once. Kevin McCarthy's leadership has been quite often uneven, and the demands in the GOP are sky-high for such posts. Scalise, too, would seem to be in line for some criticism given his status as the party's whip. The anger for now seems more focused on those 13 Republicans. It's possible Democrats would have been able to pass the bill without them. The GOP crossover votes allowed the progressives who had been holding out to vote no and stick to their principled stance. But the end result is that, objectively, this bill passed thanks to GOP votes. Whether Kevin McCarthy could have prevented the bill's passage is a valid question. He doesn't control the majority after all, but his party and its base aren't really big on that kind of nuance. And it's unlikely the anger over what transpired on Friday will subside quickly. The Republicans who voted for the infrastructure bill, the defectors, were Don Bacon of Nebraska, Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, Andrew Garbarino of New York, Anthony Gonzalez of Ohio, John Katko of New York, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, Nicole Maniotakis of New York, David McKinley of West Virginia, Tom Reed of New York, Chris Smith of New Jersey, Fred Upton of Michigan, Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey, and Don Young of Alaska.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life. I told Jalaldi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. In the previous episode, I did mention that as Muslims, we need to be very alert, we need to be very aware, we need to be vigilant. The hadith says, Al-Mu'minu Kayyisun Fatin. A mu'min is acute, alert, and we are well aware of our surroundings. We don't get tricked into simple, shallow slogans or meaningless titles, and we most certainly don't get caught in fitna. And we always remember that there's always going to be struggles, there are always going to be problems, there are always going to be sedition makers, there are always going to be pot stirrers, there are always going to be people who thrive on attention, on going against everyone else, on instigating any kind of discord or problems or fitna or things like that. That's what munafiqs do. That's what ignorant people do. That's what shaitani people do, unfortunately. And in most cases, you have no idea who they are. In most cases, you know, they're feeding you honey that has been poisoned. And so when we come across these issues, we always need to remember that the only thing that will keep us safe, religiously, spiritually, morally, socially, is having basira, having insight, being aware, being vigilant, and being with jama'ah, and understanding that that's what's going to keep us on the right path. Yes, you might have someone who comes this side or someone who comes on that side. They might be very flashy in the words that they use. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he refers to such people as a nice, soft, silky snake. When you're touching the snake, the skin of a snake, it's very soft and silky and very, very nice. But how poisonous is a snake bite?
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Therefore, we shouldn't be tricked and deceived by al-zahir, the outer appearance of how people look or how people dress or what people say. I think that's very, very important. And the reason why I'm saying this is because this word human rights is thrown around a lot. But what does human rights mean? Does the United Nations really represent the true embodiment of human rights? Are the superpowers of today really implementing human rights in the best form possible? What about the word freedom? You know, how much do we love this word freedom? But what does freedom mean? You know, where does freedom of speech and freedom of expression really exist? And that's why Islam doesn't sugarcoat things. Islam doesn't give you false pretense of what it is that you need to understand in order to attract you. You know, Islam isn't into crowd satisfaction, if I could say that. Islam is more into implementing that which is going to be the best for you in deen and dunya and akhirah without compromising. I think that's very important for us to remember. When we talk about freedom, we need to always remember that yes, as a human being, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created you as hur. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, La takun abda ghayrik wa qad ja'alaka Allah hurra. Don't be the slave of someone else when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created you, has made you a free person. At the same time, when we say that I am Abdullah, when we refer to Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, we always refer to him as Muhammad, and him being Abdullah, him being the servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we choose the words properly in English as well, because, you know, maybe slave is different to the word servant. Maybe one's optional, voluntary, one is not. But in any case, we understand that although I am a free man, although I don't need to succumb myself to a master in that particular sense. And the abolishment of slavery that we can see in Islam is way before what we can see in the so-called modern world of today. They continued on until the previous century. When you as a mu'min understand that you are a free person, and when you as a mu'min understand that you need to be a free person. You know, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, if you remember that saying that where he said that if you don't have any religion that you are affiliated to, and if you don't fear the time of judgment when resurrection is going to occur, then at least be free in your world. Kunu ahraran fi dunyakum. At least be free in your world. Why are you following Yazid? Why are you being allowing yourselves to be slaves of Yazid?
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. U.S. leaders' credibility is sagging at home and abroad as speculation swells about a possible Trump return in 2024. We're prepared for you an article written by Daniel Williams, a former foreign correspondent for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and Miami Herald, and an ex-researcher for Human Rights Watch. The piece is titled Biden's Foreign Policy Undercut by Domestic Weakness. So far, no American ally has felt a need to react to the election debacles President Joe Biden suffered recently, notably in the state of Virginia, which his party controlled but then lost, and also in lesser votes elsewhere across the country. Usually, there is no reason for, say, a German leader to comment on a vote in a middle-sized American state. But in this case, cables sent out from foreign allies' embassies in Washington will likely need to grapple with this question. Is Biden already so wounded that in just over 3 years he'll be replaced in 2024 elections and have his foreign policy initiatives overturned by a purported nationalistic populist in the image of Donald Trump, or even by Donald Trump himself? His ratings in political surveys are as bad as Donald Trump's at their worst. Voters have begun to wonder if, with the spectacle of Biden's occasional incoherent babbling, he's up to the job of the presidency. Part of allied nations' worry centers on a growing habit of U.S. presidents to hang foreign initiatives on their own signature instead of gaining wider political consensus. In America's volatile political landscape, this trend throws the staying power of U.S. policy into doubt. If a president believes he can't get consent for a treaty from two-thirds of the U.S. Senate, as constitutionally required, he forges ahead anyway and calls it something else. For example, Anne-Marie Slaughter, a former diplomat who runs New America, a Washington think tank, wrote, "The Paris Climate Accord, signed with dozens of other countries in 2015, was not labeled a treaty, but an executive agreement, binding only President Barack Obama's administration." The same was true of Barack Obama's complex deal with Iran, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. He called it a non-binding agreement that committed the United States to lifting sanctions on Iran. The late hawkish Senator John McCain complained at the time, "They can call it a banana, but it's a treaty." The weakness of each maneuver was evident when Donald Trump took power after Barack Obama, because neither the Paris Climate Accord nor the Iran nuclear deal was ratified in the Senate. Donald Trump simply overturned each with the stroke of a pen. This year, Joe Biden has quickly reinstated the Paris Climate Accord and wants to return to the Iran nuclear accord. But what will happen after 2024? William Howell, a University of Chicago political scientist, predicted America's whiplash foreign policy presents uncertainty among U.S. allies, adding, "Pervasive gridlock, polarization, and distrust that characterize our national politics will give foreign leaders some pause before entering into long-term, costly agreements with us." Max Bergman, a fellow of the Leftist Center for American Progress and specialist in relations with Europe, said, "I think there is a real sort of underlying concern that America's return may be temporary." He added, "Europeans are a little bit wary of following the lead of the United States." Joe Biden insisted his election last year represented a clear return to U.S. leadership in world affairs. At the G7 summit and NATO summit last summer, he claimed that America is back. Allies understood that he meant that the mercuric Donald Trump and his America First attitudes had been pushed off stage. They publicly welcomed Joe Biden with a hesitant satisfaction, but analysts said Western joy was tempered by an underlying fear that some version of Trump's nationalistic populism, an ideology with a two-century history in the United States, might in fact live on. Gerard Araud, a former French ambassador to the United States, commented, "After Biden, it may be Trump again." He added, "We Europeans, we have to learn to be grown up. We have to learn to defend or to handle our interests by ourselves." Virginia's election did not turn on foreign affairs, but nonetheless showed American populism is alive and well. The defeat of Virginia's state governor, deputy governor, and attorney general were largely built on dissatisfaction among parents with school bureaucrats, disdain for complaints about frameworks for teaching racial history. Nonetheless, by equating political control at home with an ability to lead the free world, Joe Biden set himself up for embarrassment. Since taking office, he claimed the United States must show the world democracy can work. On the eve of his trip to Europe recently for a G20 summit and COP26 climate conference, Joe Biden cajoled his own Democratic Party legislators in Congress to approve a $550 billion worth of programs to fight climate change. He warned, "The rest of the world wonders whether we can function." His chief congressional ally, House Leader Nancy Pelosi, said legislators must pass the spending measure so Biden wouldn't be embarrassed when he got off his plane in Europe. But the legislators failed to endorse the package, and Joe Biden left Washington empty-handed. U.S. allies abroad had already been flummoxed by a series of Biden foreign policy missteps that made them wonder whether about his competence. NATO partners criticized Joe Biden for the chaotic and incomplete evacuation of Americans and other foreigners and Afghan collaborators as Kabul fell to the Taliban. He enraged France, America's oldest ally, by quietly arranging a new anti-Chinese alliance with Britain and Australia, which denied Paris a $100 billion submarine deal with Canberra. The secretive partnership agreement also seemed a snub at continental Europe's importance as a strategic partner. The French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said, "This brutal, unilateral and unpredictable decision reminds me a lot of what Donald Trump used to do. I'm angry and bitter. This isn't done between allies." In the name of controlling climate change, Joe Biden began to curb U.S. fossil fuel production, but in order to keep American fuel prices low, he begged United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia to produce more oil. Since January, tens of thousands of illegal immigrants have crossed the United States' southern border unhindered. Biden appointed Vice President Kamala Harris to solve the problem. She traveled to Central America for talks about the flow, returned to declare the trip was a success in terms of a pathway that is about progress, and didn't take up the issue again. The migrants keep coming, to the majority dismay of Americans. In the Washington Post, a conservative Biden critic traced the beginnings of the president's electoral problems in the United States to the botched Afghan withdrawal. The critic opined, after his Afghanistan debacle, the floor fell out from under the president. On the other side of the globe, it's unclear whether China worries about Biden's image problem at home. China is convinced that the United States is inexorably hostile, no matter who is president. U.S. military leaders have labeled China a pacing threat, Pentagon language meaning it is on the military rise. U.S. naval cruisers through the contested South China Sea, which China considers its own, and support for Taiwan's separate status from China, all convince Beijing the United States won't change course whoever might be elected in 2024. China has held numerous military maneuvers around the self-governing island and staged jet bomber flights over its airspace, both as practice for a possible invasion of Taiwan and as psychological intimidation, regardless of Joe Biden's floundering at home or abroad. To counter this, Biden hopes to renew dormant alliances in the Far East and add India to the mix. But potential partners will likely think twice about joining an anti-China coalition with a perpetually wavering and increasingly weak American administration.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Power of Truth. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the power of truth. That if someone is on the truth, what power does the truth have? And we should always be towards the truth. We should leave our personal desires. We should leave the fear that we have from the community. Because if there is something which is truth, we should strike for it always. And it is the truth that basically leads us towards the success. We have seen there are many people who left the truth and they were known as hypocrites or they were known as bad people. No one has given attention to their wordings. They have no value in the society. Yes, they might have good money. They might have wealth. They might have, you know, the things that are in this world, but there is no status. There is nothing in hereafter. Even in the eyes of people, they do not have any kind of love or any respect in the eyes of people. So we need to be very much careful when we are talking about the truth, that the only thing that can take us towards the success is the power of the truth. And we must be on the side of truth. Maybe my friend has done a mistake, and I love my friend, but still, the justice tells me, the justice teaches me to be with the truth. And even if it is my brother or sister or my friend, I should be very much careful while dealing because the justice talks about the truth.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the power of truth. In the history, there's a story that once the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he went to Taif for preaching Islam. And Taif was a place where the rich polytheists used to live. Therefore, when he went there, no one has heard him, and even they did not allow him to enter the Taif. Rather, they threw stones on him. Therefore, he got injured and he left the place without saying even a single word. Later, he went to a place where there was a garden and he sat at the shadow of one of the trees. Now, this garden was from Utbah and Shayba. They were two polytheists. And when they saw Prophet injured and there was a bleeding from his leg and his body, they got happy. And then they send one of their servants, who was a Christian, towards the Prophet with the plate of grapes. And they said to him, do not talk to him. You should not talk to him. Just give him this plate and come back. Let's see what he does. So when their servant took that plate of grapes towards the Prophet, he said to Prophet that they are for you. So eat them. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam picked a grape from the bunch and said Bismillah. The servant had never heard anybody in Taif who used to use the same or similar phrase before eating. Therefore he asked him, why you use this? And the Prophet said, it looks like you're not from Taif. Who are you? He said, I'm a Christian and I live at this place. And then Prophet said to him that I am the Prophet of God. The way Yunus, who was from the same place where you belong to, was the Prophet of God, and he was my brother. So Shayba and Utbah, they noticed that their bondsman was totally engrossed in conversation. They grew with anger, and they did not want anyone to communicate with the Prophet. Therefore, the truth that was in the Prophet, which he was taking towards the people to preach them, it turned a Christian into Muslim. It turns people to be inclined towards him. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
The United Nations Food Agency has said that the number of people on the edge of famine across 43 countries had risen to 45 million as acute hunger spikes around the world. The jump from 42 million people earlier in the year was largely down to a food security assessment that found another 3 million people facing famine
in Afghanistan. The World Food Program WFP says on Monday, November 8. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, In Urgent Appeal, UN Hunger Agency Warns Millions of People Facing Starvation. Stay tuned for more. Warning that more than 45 million people around the globe, but most acutely in Afghanistan, Africa, and the West Asia region, are in imminent danger of starvation, the head of the United Nations World Food Program on Monday, November 8, urgently appealed to political leaders, the super rich, and people in the global north for help. When there is $400 trillion worth of wealth on the earth today, shame on us that we let any child die of hunger. Tens of millions of people are staring into an abyss, WFP Executive Director David Beasley said in a statement. We've got conflict, climate change, and COVID-19 driving up the numbers of acutely hungry, and the latest data show there are now more than 45 million people marching towards the brink of starvation, he added. Beasley, who traveled to Afghanistan, where the WFP is increasing efforts to provide aid to 23 million people, added that fuel costs are up, food prices are soaring, fertilizer is more expensive, and all of this feeds into new crises like the one unfolding now in Afghanistan, as well as long-standing emergencies like Yemen and Syria. In addition to Afghanistan, the WFP identified Yemen, where a six-year U.S.-backed Saudi-led intervention in a war has caused widespread hunger, as well as Syria, Congo, South Sudan, Ethiopia, and Madagascar, as the hardest hit among 43 countries suffering food crises. In an interview on Monday, November 8, Beasley, a former Republican governor of South Carolina, said that the situation in Afghanistan is as bad as you can possibly imagine. 95% of the people don't have enough food. The reporters also interviewed desperate Afghans who are bracing for an especially cold winter and who are receiving less food aid since the Taliban retook control of the country earlier this year. Fatimeh, a single mother of seven from Bamiyan in central Afghanistan, said, "I've got nothing to give the children. Soon I will have to go out and beg." The WFP says families facing acute food shortages are being forced to make devastating choices to cope with the rising hunger. In Madagascar, where pockets of famine are already a reality, some are being forced to eat low-cost white leaves or cactus to survive, the agency reports. According to WFP, the cost of averting famine globally is $7 billion. Beasley recently noted that the 400 wealthiest Americans collectively got $1.8 trillion richer during the COVID-19 pandemic, and that it would require less than 0.4% of that amount to prevent worldwide famine. Beasley told reporters, imagine that this was your little girl or your little boy or your grandchild about to starve to death. You would do everything you possibly could. And when there is $400 trillion worth of wealth on the earth today, shame on us that we let any child die of hunger.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی است.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
Some of the mistakes that we commit in different areas stem from the wrong culture that dominates our minds. If we consume extravagantly, if we copy others blindly, if we lead a wrong lifestyle, these result from cultural problems and from the culture ruling over minds. That is why these problems emerge in practice. Copying others and leading a flashy and aristocratic lifestyle is rooted in cultural matters. In fact, the software for these events is the culture of the country and the wrong and deviant culture that dominates the minds of some people. You should significantly improve cultural instruments such as the cinema, art, and audiovisual media. The press, books, and the like are also cultural instruments. They should blossom in the true sense of the word. Today, a large army of enthusiastic youth are thankfully busy working on cultural matters and in a diligent way.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If administrations and the cultural organizations of the administration help these young enthusiastic youths, great feats will surely be accomplished and indigenous steps will be taken. There are hundreds of innovative projects available to youth. When we sometimes meet with youth, we see that they are capable of accomplishing great things. Well, they need resources, and resources are at the disposal of the administration. They should be supported smartly. You should discover talents, support them, and ensure their freedom. Of course, I mean freedom within the framework of the law. And you should confront and fight against moral and cultural corruption without any consideration. The confrontation should be carried out this way. The main way to confront the enemy's soft war is to support, encourage, and appreciate proper moves in the area of culture and to stand up against wrong moves. The arena of media and culture could be, and indeed is, a great university. And on the other hand, it is a battle between good and evil, truth and falsehood. It is a cultural battlefield for fighting against those whose culture is to generate corruption in the world. We should look at it from these two perspectives.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The ongoing Saudi-imposed war has put a further strain on the already fragmented education system of Yemen. In a recent report, UNICEF said more than 2 million Yemeni children remain out of school, as nearly three-quarters of public school teachers in several governorates have not been paid for over two school years.
Since the first moment of the Saudi-led war, the educational process has been directly targeted, whether by air raids that targeted the schools and their surroundings, or by depriving teachers of their due salaries. Also, a large number of schools were converted into shelters for the displaced, and some schools were closed because they are located on the front lines of the military battles. All these factors have caused a low level of education for Yemeni children.
The report added that an estimated 1.7 million children are internally displaced and more than 8 million children do not have access to safe water, sanitation or hygiene, which contributes to a growing number of children suffering from acute malnutrition and infectious diseases such as cholera.
It is clear that targeting the educational process is a priority for the Saudi-led coalition, and for this reason, over 7 years, we have suffered a lot. And what helped us is the sense of responsibility on the part of teachers and parents. UN statistics say 2 million children do not have access to education, and 8 million children do not get their most basic needs, and this is a real catastrophe.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in March 2015, the kingdom has bombed over 1,100 schools and 180 universities, in a clear violation of the international humanitarian law that protects educational facilities as civilian objects. As the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate in Yemen due to the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade, children continue to be the ones who pay the heaviest price. UNICEF describes Yemen as the most dangerous place on earth for children to grow up. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Europe is divided over how to deal with the mounting humanitarian crisis on its borders. Some are calling for walls and barbed wire. Asylum seekers are being used as pawns in political disputes, and desperate people mercilessly pushed back and forth between borders, left to die in the space between with no food or shelter. The UN has called foul, but it seems no one is listening.
Yet the European Union's 28 members seem to be absolutely abysmally hopeless in organizing any kind of real strategy around migrants and their facilitation. And given, of course, that NATO and Europe is at the heart of causing a lot of the kind of migrancy that is a result of conflicts, you'd have thought that they would have had a little bit more in terms of their human rights and their sort of own, moral conscience to do a lot better.
States around Europe's periphery are the first destinations for asylum seekers coming via sea. Greece, Italy, and Turkey have been accused of violent pushbacks, and the UK is entertaining the idea of giving border forces immunity from prosecution if migrants die at sea.
All part of this neoliberal, neoconservative, imperialistic worldview, which much of the establishment in Europe has adopted for many, many years now. And it is fundamentally a barbaric, uncivilized, set of policies which show no signs of abating, and backed by that fear that they created within their public on the grassroots level, there's no real pressure on them from the public to refrain from continuing with their witch hunts and their targeting and their scapegoating of immigrants.
However, the UK's border forces refusing to implement the Home Secretary's plan for fear it will lead to more deaths at sea. Priti Patel is trying to introduce a clause to the Nationality and Borders Bill that will see those arriving via irregular routes receive a prison sentence of up to 4 years. But human rights organisers say Europe's compassion for survivors of war is abysmally low, considering the part they play in conflicts around the world.
Countries like France, Italy, and the UK have blood on their hands, continuing to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the likes of Israel, the last apartheid on earth, and Saudi Arabia, which has been ravaging Yemen for the last 7 years, pushing it to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The second day of the Iranian army's massive maneuver kicked off. This time, the ground force showed its might by deploying its artillery, choppers, and combat UAVs to take down mock enemy targets. This as the Navy also sent its homegrown Tareq and Ghadir submarines, which fired torpedoes against surface and subsurface targets in the Sea of Oman.
We in the Navy have upgraded our subsurface, surface, and aerial equipment, and this has allowed us to expand our intelligence dominance to as far as 2,500 kilometers from our coastline.
The ground force has so far accomplished all its assigned missions in the drill. We have so far acted in close coordination with the three other forces. This synergy is what we are trying to achieve to bolster our deterrence.
Codenamed Zulfaqar 1400, the massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems, held over a million